Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Willow, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight, and we're going to talk about a very unusual instrument, but it's becoming more prominent, especially in TV and film scores. My guest, I want to welcome to the show. He's been here before, but this is the first time we're actually going to talk about what he makes and what he loves to play. Jonathan Wilson from Togaman Guitar Viols. Jonathan, welcome so much for coming on the show.
And thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's really a pleasure. And I've seen these instruments, and we've talked about this before. He's been at several of Lonnie's LA Amp shows, and it's a fascinating instrument. So one of the things I want to do is talk about the development, because it's an unusual, very unusual instrument. But as I understand correctly, it evolved from the viola da gamba, if I'm correct.
Well, you could say it's related to the viola da gamba. It's in a lot of ways, it's quite similar. My own arrival at it, though, was a little bit of a different road. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'd say about, it goes back, I mean, almost 40 years, my gosh. I was in boarding school and was really into guitar, of course, as a kid. And I had read about this thing called the Gizmotron, which I believe is out on the market again. It was a little thing that did hurdy-gurdy wheels on an electric guitar. And it had me thinking about it a lot. And then I got interested in violin music and trying to emulate those sounds. So I was doing a lot of this Stratocaster volume knob kind of stuff. And I had a teacher in boarding school named Ron McFarlane, whose son is Seth McFarlane, actually. Mm-hmm. And I used to play in the chorus doing all that sound. And basically, he said, "Oh, you sound more like a cellist than a guitar player." So I think I took it literally, and I think by about 89, so this was going back to 84, and then by 89, I found out, I read about the arpeggione, as I had this concept in my mind of exactly what I wanted, and I didn't know it really actually existed before. And so I just hit the ceiling when I, read about this little tiny paragraph in a very long article in Encyclopedia Britannica in 1948. It was in one winter in Connecticut, and so I was it. I was from 1989 forward. I was like, it's arpeggione or bust. And so I had a rough little start in the early 90s with it. I had a prototype through all those years, and I played it. It was not built by me though, and so there were some little things I wanted to change about it. And I think by the time Y2K came around, I found out that I could probably communicate with my brain to my hands a little more directly. And so I guess I became a luthier at some point, along the road.
Well, how did you discover the arpeggione?
Well, that was the discovery was that I was actually studying the encyclopedia I was talking about violins, because I wanted to learn everything I could about violins so that I can make my violin guitar really good, you know, or at least what I would hope to be. And I was very, like I said, it was a very long read, but then there was this little article, this little paragraph that described a six-string cello tuned like a guitar, fretted with 24 frets, made by Johann Stoffer in 1823. And I just was like, oh man, that was it for me. So I didn't actually have a physical encounter with it. I'd never even seen a picture of one for quite a while, but I knew I wanted an arpeggione. So I created what I interpreted to be an arpeggione, which was essentially, now the earlier version was a 25 and a half inch scale, just like a guitar. And that was a little bit unwieldy to play, actually. I mean, a 25 and a half inch scale Stratocaster feels great in my hands. But for this purpose, and actually, you know, bowing, and I shortened it down to, when I got to the early Y2Ks, I redesigned it. And one day I was working at the time at Castle's Music, and I grabbed a viola off the wall, and it was a 16 inch scale, and I just started playing it the way I would my arpeggione, and I'm going, you know what, maybe I should like revisit the scale length thing, because this is a lot more comfortable. So I shot between the 16 and a half inch and the 25 and a half inch scale, came to 21, which it turns out that's basically a quarter size cello scale. And anyway, I made it such that the nut is a roughly eye level, so I'm not like reaching up here to play a low F or whatever. This thing is tuned, by the way. Actually, I have it in a drop D, but it would be normally E, A, D, you know, the same tuning. So if I play that D chord, we get that. So, yeah.
Now, so let's talk a little bit, because you obviously spent some time developing the ergonomics of the instrument. You might want to hold it up, because I noticed that you have a stand on it.
Well, this is a leg peg.
Okay.
And really, I have, this one's fairly short. Sometimes I make it a little longer. But really, it's meant to wrap the right leg around. And then in this
so it's not meant to stand here, on there.
My earlier electrics had a lower curve here, so I kind of kept it. Because the acoustics, they don't weigh themselves down like an electric does. And so, if you know, the thing is like really all over the place. Now, viola da gambas, they typically play them between the legs like this, and with an upward, you know, like palm up bow grip.
Right.
And I like the sound of it better when it's not that way. But also, too, I was really trying to approach it like a guitar player. And it's sort of like I know most people think Jimmy Page, and Jimmy Page, as much as I've been influenced by him as a guitar player, I never really connected him to the bowed guitar thing until later. And it was sort of like, you know, the sort of palm up underhand grip on the bow, and we're able to, you know, have a fairly relaxed, you know, stance with it. So, and there's other things about the bow that I can talk about too, but really it just had, I designed this for how I play it, not how, you know, any musicologist or violin teacher, you know, they all told me I was wrong in how I played this instrument and how dare I play it that way. And it turned out that from an old painting it's a Paolo Veronese painting, which depicts the water to wine scene in the Bible. Of course, they're all wearing togas. And so I call it Toga Man, because it was actually the painter himself was the guy with the toga playing, in a similar stance. And so that was my smoking gun. That was my way of saying, hey, this was going on for centuries before you guys even were making... you know, it's funny, the violin and cello family grew up sort of separately and in parallel. the early viola da gambas or viola da gambas, depends on what side of the Rockies you're on or whatever, how we pronounce it, I guess. Basically, Spain was the birthplace of the guitar, and you had vihuelas and you had lutes. And the Moroccans brought their bows over the Strait of Gibraltar, and when they invaded Spain, they took the bows with them. It was sort of a Reese's peanut butter cup thing where the chocolate landed in the peanut butter or whatever, and they just said, hey, this is really cool. You know, they were taking their lutes and their... and they were like, hey, that's pretty cool. Let's keep that. So they started building them that way.
And so it's even the origins of the viola da gamba is the vihuela.
Yeah, and they had two different vihuelas. They had vihuela de mano and vihuela de arco. And the de mano was plucked, so you know... plucked, and then of course the arco, you had the bow, and which I think is pretty cool. It kind of gives a real more colorful history that most people don't know about the guitar or its variants, and right. So this is quite literally the Jimmy Page thing happened well over five centuries ago, or even more. There was, they're very similar to what in the Middle East they were playing rebabs and certain other instruments that were bowed, and they were, even in Asia you have these sort of, they're really cool. I've seen them on YouTube. They're like these two-string bowed lutes.
Erhus
are another one. That has the sort of the skin head, like a banjo. But the thing is one thing about the erhu is really interesting is it shows the directionality of the bowing, because really when you bow a string, it follows the direction of the bow. So if you go to an electric guitar and you bow it, it's really like weak, because the planar motion of the string is such that it's not really going to move the top, and especially if the string is low down at the top, the string is essentially traveling in the same direction as the top is. So when you have a taller bridge, you have a sound post underneath the treble foot, yeah. And that acts like a hinge, like sort of a kind of a door hinge in a way. And when you actually bow it, it takes the bass side and pumps the bass bar side, and it's a sort of a pumping action that happens.
Well, that's why Jimmy Page did it mostly on the Les Paul, because the neck's angled.
True.
On his telly, it was much more difficult because it was flat.
Right. Right. And then, and the problem is the magnetic pickups, or any pickups really, but that's a good example, is that the flux field, you're kind of putting it in the plane of rejection. So it's really weak. So what happens is you'd bow the string and then it would like get loud as soon as you remove the bow, but it would be much quieter. So you had to put like a disproportionate amount of gain to get anything out of it. And it was a hot mess when you actually did pull the bow away from it, which you can see in a lot of those Zeppelin videos of Page bowing. And interestingly enough, there's a guy before Page named Eddie Phillips from The Creation. And he was in the same studios, and they had a couple little hits, Painter Man and Making Time, where he was bowing his 335, and I talked to Eddie several years ago. He called me up because he says, hey, thanks for getting the story right on your website. And basically he said that they would often be in the same studios, and so somebody would leave a violin bow, and so one of these '60s guitar players would go, oh cool, all right, let's make some noise, and so the bow kind of got kicked around, and I think that's where the origins for both Eddie and both Jimmy Page came from. At least that's what Eddie's account of it is.
Now let me ask you, what's the radius of that fretboard?
Well, in the early days, I had something that was a little less intense. It was about a 2.5-inch radius at the bridge, and it was roughly 7-ish, 7.5-ish, kind of like a old Fender. And basically this is more of an ellipse. It's a lot steeper on the bass side. And so when I designed the fingerboard, I had to start over because I was, you know, getting frustrated with the limitations of the other boards. Because you couldn't really, you know, the problem is that the higher strings are more taut. And the lower strings are a little more, so when you press the bow, you could, you know, inadvertently hit the neighboring strings instead. So you have to steepen it up a little bit to compensate for the tension difference. And what I did was I created an optimal bridge first. And then once I was happy with the string separation, then I designed the fingerboard around that curve.
Hold up the guitar so I can see they can see the bridge. Because it's kind of lopsided. If you let me get a picture of it and then just show it towards the other camera here. Hold on a second. Let me just get a good shot of that. Just hold it right here. Let me. So if you take a look, you can see it dips more here, and it's a milder curve here. So it's kind of going this way, kind of leans in a little bit this way. Thank you.
Okay.
And what's that fretboard made out of?
That's a composite. It's got a carbon graphite mixture in it. And it's basically has carbon fiber inside of it. It's kind of a layup. It's a whole kind of we mold the shell, and then there's a vacuum. We put a sort of a vacuum clamp on the back of it with the wet carbon fiber on the back of it with the resin, and then so it cures, and then we, you know, hit it to the belt sander, and then
now what about the frets? Are those?
That's all one piece.
So it's it's all the fretboard.
It's everything about it is one piece outside of that, yeah, including the nut. So everything is, you think about like when, and the advantage to it, by the way, is it dramatically makes it more scuff resistant. So in fact, see, my earlier fingerboards were metal frets. And they were great when we were using guitar strings like flat wound strings. Jazz flats like D'Addario Chromes or anything similar to that. And that's the sound you hear in a lot of these movies from the 2000s, like 300 and a lot of things that Tyler Bates has done. And that was a good combo for that, but it was the thing was that they're poor bowed strings, actually. Guitar strings, when you lean into them too hard with a bow, it pulls them sharp. So I really started going over to, I think about 2010-ish, we started going to these cello strings. And I had a couple clients in the Palisades who were kind of A-B-ing them, you know, with different brands and stuff like that. So we found out the D'Addario Helichords were really our best sounding ones. And so I went to that. And then I redesigned the bridge to the strings, and I redesigned the fingerboard. For a while, we were making like the fingerboards with a CNC in the rough, and then I would hand polish it out and put the frets in like a jewelry wire. But the problem is it would chew the strings right up. So now these strings are about maybe $150, $160 a set.
Whoa.
Okay, this is not like going to Guitar Center and buying a little, you know, set of Slinkies or something. So that was problematic. So when people were going through their high E strings, like, you know, it would just basically eat them for lunch. I really got to the point where I said, regardless of tradition, regardless of materials, regardless of bias, you know, is it ebony, is it this or whatever, I just said, what would the ultimate playing surface really be like?
Mm-hmm.
And so I imagined it being really a very low friction. So we can kind of wiggle the strings of it with no noise on it. And the other thing that I found that these fingerboards do better is the wooden boards, sometimes you'd have hot spots on them. So in other words, you would have some notes louder than the other. And that was also a problem. So this sort of flattened out the EQ a little bit, and it was nice in the studios because, and by the way, 99% of these go right into a studio. And they get under mics so you can hear all every little thing about them. So if we're actually, you know, wiggling, I don't get the real finger noise as much. You know, it's very much more quieter than the wood or your hand. So this has really worked out very well, and I'm quite proud of them, actually.
How long do the strings last?
You know, they can be on there, depending on how, I mean, you know, these have been on for over a year, and they're still fine. So that's the good news. The bad news is they're expensive. The good news is they stay on a lot longer.
And now with this setup, you don't get too many breakage.
No, not. I haven't broken any at all ever myself.
Now let's talk a little bit. What's the fretboard's this composite? What's the neck made out of?
This particular neck's maple. A lot of the stock models that I'm making, though, it surprises people. I use alder for the necks because I like the lighter sound. It gives it a little more bloom in it. The bodies are typically nowadays they're what violins would or guitars would be made of, but maple back and sides, using a Lutz spruce, which is sort of a hybrid of Engelmann and Sitka. I found that combo to be pretty nice, so I've been sticking with the Lutz.
Go ahead and turn it around, and I want to show the fretboard. I'm going to try to get...
Yeah, you want to see the fretboard?
The neck on the back, so they can see a little bit. Now, are those locking geared nut tuning keys, or just like regular...
Yes, they're actually...
Flip it around and get the back wood. Wow, that's beautiful.
Yeah, they're... They're basically they're Vintners from Germany, and they're planetary gears. So they look like friction pegs, but in fact they're geared. So we can get it really dialed in. And for a while I was doing like a 3-3 combo with, like, I was using everything from Spurzels, and then eventually I went to Planet Waves locking tuners and the trim locks. And then, of course, people would be terrorized because those things would, like, you know, chop the strings, and they don't know they're chopping the strings. And so I like this. It's a much more cleaner assembly. And
but they're pretty accurate.
Fine-tune. They're you know, really quite dead on. Yeah.
Now, with the bridge, how do you know where the bridge goes? If, like, let's say you're changing the strings, is it?
Well, the best practice, really, is once the thing's set up, and you are changing the strings, just change one at a time under tension.
Oh, okay.
And then that way you don't have to go through all the setup, and
does
you don't
that
worry about
move
the
a lot, or does it? Is it pretty?
It
stiff?
Can a little bit over time. I mean, things can inadvertently bump it, but also too, just the time it settles in and gets tuned and retuned, it can kind of. And I have to go through a whole lecture on how to, you know, move it around and get it just right. But basically, like a guitar, it's going to be pretty much, you know, what this length is to the 12th fret, the 12th to that is going to be pretty much, you know, where it's going to be. Now, some people do see that it's a little wavy and it's potato chippy looking, and that's because it's hand-carved to be compensated. So when I actually set this thing up, I'm using a dummy bridge that is adjustable. Okay. Now, the adjustable bridges sound horrible. The more moving parts you put on a bridge, the worse it just sounds. But it gets it in tune, and so then I can copy that pattern, and then I carve the bridge to that pattern. So that's the other caveat, is you have to stick to the same brand of strings and same tensions that I issue it with. I mean, you can experiment, but you might throw that off a little bit.
So if you want to change strings, you have to have a new bridge.
Well, if it's really, like, something that's really badly wonky, then yeah. I've had people put B-to-B tuning and change their strings, and it's pretty close. It's, you know, they can kind of work with it. But I like to set it up to the tuning that it's going to be in because, you know, we can be a little more precise that way.
Now, where is the pickup?
The pickup is it's right on the bass bar. It's kind of, I don't know if you can see that inside.
Oh, it's a contact pickup.
Well, what it is, it's a L.R. Begg's Lyric pickup, which is a hybrid of kind of a mic and a pickup. And typically, I don't know if you've ever been familiar with, like, the sound of what a mic sounds like in an acoustic guitar, but generally it's pretty horrible.
So that's the, what was the name of that pickup?
It's the L.R. Begg's Lyric.
Lyric.
And what I do is I have it phantom powered through this EMG box here. So it is an active pickup, but there's no battery inside the instrument. So we're just sending, like this cable's a TRS cable. So a stereo cable going to the box to the instrument. So I've kind of modified the thing at the board such that we can send the positive up the ring.
So this Lyric pickup, is it like, you know, LR Bags makes a dual pickup system where there's a piezo and the microphone one. Is that the microphone one?
Yes, this is the microphone contact pickup. And so it's right under the bass foot of the bridge. It's right directly on the sound, the bass bar, actually. So it gets a pretty nice representation of the sound, and plus it's right... It's on the business part of where the, you know, the bridge is really kind of moving. So I never liked the piezo pickups. And in fact, most violin and cello pickups I've ever heard are just, to me, they're horrible. And a lot of my customers feel the same way. We've been very, very happy with this. And the thing is that these were designed for acoustic guitars. So they weren't really, they didn't have me in mind when they designed it. But I tried it. I used to use everything from K&Ks to whatever, and they were good for, you know, contact pickups. But these, the Lyric is just a lot more real sounding. And
well, it seems that it has enough top end.
Yeah,
that's usually why you want the piezo, just to get a little, you get the brighter and then get the girth from the other pickup.
Right. And sometimes though, I found that. You know, it'd be like rubbing your nails on chalk, though, the kind of sound you'd get. It mm-hmm. would just sort of, and what you'd wind up doing is electronically trying to, you know, EQ it. And this thing, it comes nice pretty much right out of the box.
Well, it has plenty of top end. It seems like it does.
And yeah, and you can, there is a little adjustment on this thing. It's like a little tiny Phillips kind of screw, and you set it and forget it, and you just kind of do it to your rig. There's a little flywheel right there on the, it's a presence control, I guess. It's, you know, how they used to say that on the Marshall amps. It was sort of a marketing term for just another, you know, set it and forget it. So if it's a little too bright or too dark, you can kind of go either way, and you just dial it in that way. I'm very happy with it. I regularly put these in, and a lot of my clients, they just plug them straight in to Pro Tools. Because a lot of these guys working in TV and film, they don't want to have to sit there and move mics around all day to, you know, get a quick cue. They're dealing with a schedule where it's like, I need that thing in like less than 20 minutes for a network show.
Bam. Mm-hmm.
Make it happen. So that works out pretty well. But also, I found that working with the pickup and a good mic in front of it, the sound of the two is just wonderful. And if you hard pan them, it's kind of magical too.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, at the end of the day, these instruments are sort of, I guess they're tools, you know.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to ask you a little bit about the bracing of that. But before that, is there any TV shows that you know of that we can listen to that would have this that are easy to check out?
Yeah, I would say there's Kevin Kiner does a lot of, he's done everything from, with my older instruments, he's done like CSI Miami to all the way up to, there was something on Netflix called Making a Murderer that it appeared in quite a lot. He used it plucked there too a lot. There's a current show on, I believe it's, I can't remember, is it Showtime or HBO? I think it's Showtime. It's City on a Hill. And, let's say, here's the big one. How about Game of Thrones for so many seasons? That's been like, what, 8 or 9 seasons? I don't remember what it was. Now, the one thing I want to clear up is the opening theme is not the instrument. But a lot of the other stuff he does in there is.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he's not that public about that because, you know, these people in these, you know, unions or whatever, I don't know. But
well, I mean, I would assume you're still a guitarist when you play this.
That's the thing, is that because, you know, our points of reference are all the same, all our points of harmony are pretty much the same. I could take, you know, like I said, I'm just taking that little D chord there, but we can... So it...
How many strings can you bow at the same time to do like chords?
I would say two or three. Even though you can, of course, like the name Arpeggione, probably from that old one that Stouffer built a long, long time ago, it might have been called the Arpeggione just because you could do arpeggios so well with it.
So the Arpeggione was really curved too.
Yeah, I mean, it was. You have to be able to make it a bowed instrument where you can. The idea is that if you want to bow an individual string, you can. But to do that, you have to have a certain arcuate curvature.
Right.
And it needs to harmonize with the fingerboard, though. So there's a lot of detail in the geometry.
Yeah. No. So there, you can. It's probably more common to do a double stop on there than to do a triple.
Well, you know, sometimes I'm not really warmed up, and honestly, I haven't been practicing much. So there's some thirds there. But yeah, you can, and the other thing is, too, that I think that a lot of people think, they think, well, it's fretted, so you're limited. You're just going to have static notes or whatever. And that's not the case. You could be fretless at will. So in other words, if we want to be... Or,
yeah,
so if I press down, I can get that chromatic rush. Or, so basically we can, and you can learn, you can kind of, with practice, you can take like a thirds, for example, and you can learn how to kind of do that. It's, I would say it's, again, it's like playing slide with your fingertips.
Right.
So you're not pushing the string all the way down to where it's going to engage with the fret or the stopping point, I like to call it. But when you want, that's the beauty of it too, because you could do a phrase where you're involving a lot of techniques in just one little pass. You know, you could be doing.
Now, I was going to just ask you, and you just did it for me. You bend the string like a guitar player.
Sure.
But yeah. You don't roll your, for vibrato, you don't roll your.
Well, you can, though. I suck at the roll thing, so I kind of have to go. I kind of do it like more of a slide guitar. I have clients who are really good at the roll thing, and so they kind of go right on top of the fret. I'm still kind of a guitar player, so it's like I kind of go right before the fret. Some people will maybe hit a point like a little too far back, and what happens is the string will actually miss the fret because it's going, like, remember that planar motion I was describing? Suddenly it's passing over it and creating another stopping point. So that can be a little, they're great when you need those little, like, clean chords and things like that. And but you're not limited to that. You can do a rock star vibrato on it, or you could do a classical style vibrato on it. So you're not, you've got the whole rainbow.
Now, is it hard to do, like in violin and cello, to do the harmonics? To do bow a harmonic, like from the... I know you can't do it from the lower register because it's too wide. You have to.
You
do
mean?
It
oh, you mean like spreading a finger distance or something?
To hit the to get the harmonic.
Well, but you know, a lot of these harmonics that we know are going to come right out.
Oh, you can do it like that. You don't have to. You don't have to tap it.
So you can. So you can hear all of them. All of them.
So you're just lightly touching the string.
Right. So in other words, instead of pushing it down to where it's going to create a stopping point, it's just that light touch that you do normally. Like, when you're tuning a guitar, when you're hitting harmonics and... Right? So another thing that's pretty cool is you could go... I'm going to take, for example, on the B string, I'm going to go to the fifth fret, and I'm going to go up... an octave where that is, and now if we take the bow and bow right over that, it sounds like a flute.
Weird.
And if we do that with maybe something like, here's like a little A chord barred. So, you know, there's these, all these little sounds. The one, I think one of the things that appeals to film composers about this instrument is that it's also a sound design tool.
Right, right.
You know, you can...
it's amazing that you're getting that kind of a...
You can just do all kinds of crazy, you know, things with it.
Well, that going down, when you were going down the harmonics and you were...
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, you get all the natural harmonics out of it. What's really curious, I don't know, sometimes I can do it and sometimes I can't, but it's almost weird that you find like a dominant seventh in there somewhere. It doesn't make sense that it would do that. I can't do it right now. I'm too on the spot to do that. But
now, tell me a little bit about the top, how it's braced.
Well, it's like a violin. It has a bass bar that goes right directly under the bass foot of the bridge. And in the underneath the treble side, you have a sound post that's in there. So that's actually holding the top up on that side. The bass side's kind of held up by the bass bar on the other side. So there's really, really just that's the entirety of the bracing.
There's
no
other bar, like a fan bracing or like a typical guitar.
No. You know what? My first acoustic, which Kevin Kiner now has, it actually did have sort of an X-brace-ish kind of top, and we were trying to make it like an acoustic top. The problem was that impeded the actual movement that is associated with, like I was saying earlier, it's kind of like the gingerbread man with one foot hinged on where the sound post is, and it's rocking that bass bar up and down as a pumping motion. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was funny. It was like if you look up guys like Lloyd Lohr, who was absolute genius, who was the guy at Gibson a long time ago. He didn't fit into that corporate culture. but he did some lectures, and Roger Siminoff has a couple of his books of his lectures that some girl at the time took very great notes, and it's like literally a book. And it was kind of through studying some of Lohr's work that I realized that X bracing was completely not working. Now, what happened was that one got smashed in DHL, the top did. So I said, hey, while I'm at it, let me redesign the top. And so I made the first prototype. We call it Old Faithful. And if you go on some of my old, from maybe 10 or 12 years ago, some of the old YouTube videos of the day, you can see Old Faithful on there. And it was the first, I took just some horrible piece of pine. I was just testing the design, and it just stayed on the instrument. Kevin liked the way the thing sounded, and so we...
Because that's not that curved of a finger top. It's not curved.
This particular one's not as much. I would say the other ones we do kind of are. We kind of compression bend them. And they're partially carved and partially bent. This, I don't really let this particular one out of the shop. The bridge is a little higher than I normally like to go. So sometimes somehow the next set when we were doing it didn't... but it lives around as a demo model. But generally, when I have the right amount of tension, it really doesn't seem to settle that much. In fact, we've changed the way a lot of our architecture is. This neck, for example, the block that's inside is the same piece of wood, so it's not a glued to a block. It's not glued to a dovetail.
So
we actually put it into a jig that's perfectly aligned, and we get the right, you know, in this case, I don't know, something must have slipped that day, but generally we get them perfectly dead center, and we get them, get the exact, basically the pitch of the neck to get the bridge at the desired height, and that's been working out very well. And this is what I call a Spanish fox neck joint. And the reason I'm calling it is because on the bass side, it's like a Spanish guitar that's where it's more of a saw curve in, and we just tuck the skin into there instead of, you know, making it like... And then on the other side, it's a twisted cutaway where it's like literally right on the...
Hold on a second.
And
turn it a little more like that. There we go.
And so basically, that was inspired by the work... there's a very talented luthier from Switzerland I met at the Florida show many years ago named Lucas Brunner. And so I contacted Lucas and I said, I'm sort of ripping your idea off. Are you cool with me calling it the Brunner cutaway? He says, don't worry, I stole it from Charles Fox.
Nah.
So I call it the Spanish Fox neck joint.
Spanish Fox neck joint. That's funny. That's interesting that the, so you have a lot of option. You don't have to have it angled that much because that's a pretty big bridge. Have you tried them where they're a little lower?
Well, what
not,
happens?
Not the action, but I mean,
what happens? The bridge, if you, the lower you get, the weaker the sound is.
Oh, really? Okay.
And so, but then again, you can have it too high and you can be putting too much pressure on it. This one's kind of sort of acting like that a little bit. But again, this was sort of a prototype. We were trying the new Stouffer heads, and we've kind of tuned them in since then a lot more. But
any problems with the top warping from that?
No, I mean, I haven't. Once they settle in, they just kind of stay there. Now, I've had somebody leave one in a sunroom in direct sunlight, and it would do all kinds of horrible stuff, and they live right near the ocean, so it's like, you know, there's some things you really can't do. Now, I should mention that I'm working on a series of composite builds made out of carbon fiber, but I'm also migrating into things like flax and hemp. Now, those aren't ready for prime time yet, but I'm working on them.
Mm-hmm.
And that way they can take any weather.
I'm curious if anybody's asked you to make this type of instrument as a bass.
I get that a lot. My biggest problem is I've always had a backlog of this particular thing to where the bandwidth it takes for me to go in and engineer another instrument. I've also had requests for 7 strings. But then again, now see, we're using modern strings, which have a very much higher tension to get the desired sound we're after. But, you know, again, I'd have to revisit the whole architecture. I'd have to make a new fingerboard. I'd have to retool it. And the timeout is just too killer to do it. Especially when I've got in the past, I've had anywhere from a year to a year and a half. Nowadays, we generally turn these things around within a few months with our current, status. But mostly, a lot of people have waited like 9 months or more. To get, not that it takes that long to build the instrument itself, it just takes that long to get through the queue. And we're a very small firm. My son works with me now. And so, you know, just a couple of us, making a lot of sawdust. And
so there is a waiting list for these.
Typically, yeah. But I mean, right now, I think as of the last so many months, we've kind of caught up a little bit. So we're kind of at the point where, well, unless, anything changes and we get inundated with a bunch of new orders. I always tell people, it's like, whatever I tell you today could be not true tomorrow morning if a few people call me and place an order. And generally, we just build them in project rounds. So it's not the whole, thing up. And I'd say, one third of our business is California. The other third is the lower 48, and the other third is international, Europe and Asia and Australia, Canada. So, it's international.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. It's a great instrument. I mean, it's really versatile.
Well, thank
and
you.
Also, too, plucking it, it has a not as much of a sustain. You're sustaining now, but I mean, like, if you're doing like a bass line, dum dum dum, it's almost like a plucking like a cello, but it has a little more attack than like in a classical guitar or flamenco guitar.
Yeah, it's sort of somewhere between a pizzicato, viola, cello, and maybe almost a harpy classical guitar, but sort of morphed in there. And like I said, a lot of the composers who've been using these use the plucked side of it just to get that different, you know, kind of sound.
I could see you doubling that with a guitar.
Right. It's not going to have the same kind of, you know, attack or ring as a, you know, it's not going to have that kind of thing like a Martin D35 or something like that, or a Les Paul or a whatever, but it is definitely its own thing. We chose these D'Addario helichords because I think it was they were designed by Ned Steinberger for his instruments, and they have a little bit more of a pluck ring to them than typical violin and cello strings do. But they also, what I like about them a lot is they have a fast bow attack, which is nice when you're especially doing all those like kind of arpeggios, and it's got a really nice grip on them. So, and there is a difference. It's like, you know, when you go to try the inexpensive student cello strings, it's just night and day.
Yeah. Well, we're already out of time. I told you we'd go by fast. The website to check all this out is togamanguitars.com, and he's got some interesting, he talks a little more about the history of it, and you can see more what he's talking about and the options that are available. Do you want to go ahead and just, you were doing something with the looper a little bit before the show. Do you want to take us out with a little bit of a...
I'll try. I might fall apart here, but...
Well, just at least give him an idea of the potential. I mean, sonically... This is an interesting instrument to have in your arsenal, especially for studio work. I'm waiting to see somebody out there use it live because it does have its point. Thank you again for coming, and I love this instrument. It's great. I got to start saving up for one. Everybody, thank you so much. We will see you next week. Have a great week, and we will talk with you later. Take care. Bye-bye. Let me get the...